Empire podcast this week. It's Tee Hiddy Pod Island as Tom Hiddleston pops in once again for a chat. You know, we're really going to have to start changing the locks on that guy. Plus, all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that's looking to buy a new suit. Do you think Jeff Goldblum's done with his Thor Ragnarok costume? Just a thought. Just a thought. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, which this week is brought to you in association with those wonderful people at Three, the mobile network that allows you to use your phone in 42, count them, 42 destinations abroad at no extra cost. Believe me, it saved me a lot of money in the past when I've gone to the States and streamed stuff on my phone. What was I streaming? Well, that's none of your business, and I'd like to thank you to stay out of my personal affairs. Thank you very much. Moving on swiftly. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, both of whom were shocked, I tell you, by the measures introduced in this week's budget by the Chancellor of the Exchequer. First up is our geek queen, who was dismayed by the move to reduce the price of Hamilton tickets in the West End by 50% after she'd remortgaged her house to buy thousands. It's Helen O'Hara.
Yeah, I don't think that they would ever do that in the budget. They'd raise the prices, wouldn't they?
No, I think they cut the prices.
They cut the prices.
This is a government for the people, by the people.
Okay.
They want the people to see Hamilton.
Super duper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last but not least is our editor-in-chief, a woman who was similarly taken aback by the new mandate that all podcast hosts should be paid a six-figure sum. It was worth a try. It was worth a try, Terry White. Hello, how are you?
Good, Chris. How are you?
I am super duper. Not super dapper, though, because I can't find a suit for the Empire Awards. The three Empire Awards, which are next week.
Next Sunday, the 19th of March. I'm really glad you seem to not remember that date.
I know the date. I know the venue. It's the Grosvenor House. No. It's somewhere in London.
It's at the Roundhouse in Camden.
The Roundhouse in Camden.
So trendy. This is cool.
So trendy.
There we go.
And why do you need a suit, Chris?
Because I'm going.
And?
But I'm co-hosting.
Yes, you are. With me. I don't know if we've told anybody this yet.
I don't think we have, no.
No, I'm not sure if we're allowed to or supposed to.
Are we not?
No.
Oh, it's too late now. Because this is live.
Yeah.
We can't cut this bit out.
This is awesome. I feel like I'm with celebrities.
Is it meant to be a big surprise?
I'm sure it will be a surprise.
It'll be a shock for many.
I don't know about meant to be a surprise. Yes, a surprise.
Please welcome your hosts, not famous people.
And everyone in the room is going, what? Who are these people?
But literally everyone in this room is famous.
Yeah.
They couldn't get a famous person.
Yeah, I'm on a table with people who are way more famous than these two charlatans on stage. But I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be exciting. You'd be delighted to know I have started writing the script.
Good.
Is that the one you put online yesterday?
That is the one I put online the other day. Yeah.
Yeah, and it said something along the lines of, Words here. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You'll be glad to know that since I wrote that, I have inserted some words.
Are those words welcome to this year's Empire Awards?
Shit. Have I included you on the collaboration part
of
this?
Yeah, I'm on the Google Doc. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a penis joke?
There is.
Yeah, of course there is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a big one.
Oh, Chris.
What?
No one believes that.
This is true. This is so true. I'm overcompensating so much. I'm so lonely. Shall we have a question?
Oh, probably better.
Yeah. This week's question is related to the Logan spoiler special, which is currently available for you to pour into your ears with great love and care. It's out right now. It features us three, primarily, because James Dyer got a phone call from Arnold Schwarzenegger halfway through it and had to run.
Not even kidding.
Not kidding. Genuinely, that happened. And so he ran off to do his thing. We talked about Logan for ages, and we also had Jim Mangold, the director of Logan, which is fantastic. If you haven't seen it, go and see it. Check out the Logan spoiler special. But we did get a question from someone, which came in a little bit too late for inclusion on the special, and I thought it deserved its moment in the sun here. However, me being me, I didn't note down the name of the person who sent in the question. So, you know who you are, and thank you for this question. And it was basically something along the lines of, rank the X-Men movies in the order of Wolverine's hair. So the best, right, from best to worst.
Okay. We can do this.
I think we can absolutely do this. I think this should be an in-depth discussion that takes 4 hours.
Oh, it might be, you know.
It just might be. I think I may have come to the right place here.
All right. I think I would say...
Should we go through film by film first?
Okay, okay.
Let's go through
chronologically.
Film by film, chronologically.
Yep.
So X-Men.
Yep.
All right, so his hair in that, they didn't quite get it right.
No.
They were a little tentative.
There's a
about
lot
the,
of hairspray going on there.
Gel.
Yeah.
A lot of gel.
A
lot of gel going on. In fact, that movie, you can see his hair changing throughout the film as they get a little bit more confident about the... What's the phrase for the Wolverine hair with the big, the peaks? Is that, you know,
peaks
it's not Ray Reardon, it's not
really
Dracula.
Know.
Yeah, I don't think there is, I don't think there is
I don't
such
think that's a
term.
Recognised no. hairstyle. It's not like Flock of Seagulls or, you know,
but it's kind
duck
of,
butt or whatever.
At times in the X-Men movies, it does tend to go towards Flock of Seagulls
it
territory.
Does, yeah, it certainly, it looks a little bit seagullish.
Okay.
But I think actually X-Men and X2 are probably his worst hair. Now, X2, as you know, is great in all other ways. But his hair, if you look at that hair, it is not great.
Well, that's X-Men, isn't it? Right, that picture you got up there.
I've got X-Men here and X-Men The Last Stand, which is terrible. It's very Buffon.
There's a moment in X-Men 2. I think his hair is decent in X-Men 2. It's not too bad. It's an attempt. Again, they were a bit more confident. They were trying to go for a little bit more of the comic book Wolverine. But I think they realised that the comic book Wolverine is actually a little bit ridiculous. And if you walked down the street looking like that, people would cross the street to avoid you. But there's a moment in X-Men 2. There were reshoots towards the end. And Hugh Jackman had gone off to do Van Helsing with his incredible extensions.
Oh, his lovely,
and
luscious locks.
So when he came back to do the reshoots for X-Men 2, they had a problem, which was he had way more hair than he had previously. So there are shots in X-Men 2, specifically the scene with Scott and Logan towards the end when they're sobbing about Jean, where Logan has just the most stupid, buoyant, Buffon, 6 feet tall hairdo, because they're trying desperately to cover up the extensions. So they shoot him from a low angle as well, which doesn't help. So it looks like a skyscraper of hair. So check that out. That'll ruin X-Men 2 next time you see it.
There's something quite victory rolls about it. It's a little bit, you know, I'm waiting for my husband to come home from war.
Yep.
Whatever will I do about the rations?
Yeah.
I hope his plane doesn't go down.
Oh,
also,
my God.
It touches his sideburns. So it's kind of, in moments, it's like an all-in-one hair... Hair? What would you? That's like a full hair face piece.
That is a great line. Yeah,
a full hair face piece. I like it.
I challenge you to grow one, Chris. A full hair face piece.
I can't.
Grow. This is what he's been doing for. He's been trying.
I can't grow hair.
Dirty.
I can't grow any hair on any part of my body. There's a disconcerting image.
Wow, that's something we need just to know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Me
totally,
neither.
Totally barren.
So I think he got better hair in his own films.
Okay.
Generally speaking,
I think the hair in X-Men 3 is okay. It's just a little bit.
I mean, I'm just
a little bit divorced dad.
Oh, it's sad dad.
It is. It's a, you know, sad dad going to the nightclub to try and pick up the ladies,
crying
and,
into his betting slips.
Yeah, I used to have hair like this when I was 20. I've still got it. That's what that hair is. All right. So then there's a Wolverine.
Yeah, I quite like his hair in the Wolverine. I know it's not a brilliant film, but he's quite sort of...
X-Men Origins Wolverine.
X-Men Origins Wolverine.
That's good hair, but
it's not
Wolverine hair.
It's not Wolverine hair, but it's bouncy and bodyful and full of life. It's sort of Oscar Isaac, Adam Driver levels of bouncy, full-bodied hair, which, as we all know, is the dream.
Oh, you know what it is? That is Andrea Pirlo hair.
I don't know what that is.
He is one of the classiest footballers of all time. He is an absolute man crush. And that is, ooh, hello.
I mean, it's okay. A little bit Jesus Christ hair.
It's not Jesus
it's
Christ
It's a little
hair.
Bit Jesus.
It's imagine, too short, though.
Imagine Jesus had a trim.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's going to, he's got...
So we're thinking really Andrew Garfield in Silence, really.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah, it is actually Andrew Garfield in Silence hair. Yeah, that's true.
All right, okay. So let's move on.
Okay. The Wolverine, a bit closer to a buzz cut. But still has the peaks a little bit on either side. There's a suggestion that he was like number two on top on the sides and then number three on the edges.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of thing. Except probably different numbers. I don't really know. But
I think
it's
he cuts
not
his
bad.
Own hair.
Presumably. I mean, if you had claws in your hands, would you not?
Precisely. This is the thing. Does his hair have a healing factor? That's what I want to know. So if he cuts his hair, does it immediately start growing back?
Well, no, because your hair's dead.
Yeah.
Only your follicles are alive.
So only if you pulled it out of the root that it would. And it reaches everybody's hair.
What?
Regenerates.
I've learned so much about hair today. This is amazing. It's like I've joined a hair club for men. I wish I could join a hair club for men.
Start one with James Dyer.
Oh, but he's long gone. I mean, my stable door is bolting, but his bolted a long time ago.
Sorry, James.
I've seen pictures of James with hair. when he was a teenager, and he had a proper
fake
if anyone
news.
Knows what James Dyer looks like, if you don't know what James Dyer looks like, just grab a Jason Statham DVD and just take a look any DVD and just take a look at the cover of it, and that's basically James Dyer. But in his olden days, back in days of yore, he had long cascading blonde locks because he was a proper banger, wasn't he? He was a proper thrasher. He loved to do the metal.
He tells me this and I simply just cannot believe
no,
it.
No,
you have
true.
To see it to
he's
believe
like
it.
He
it's
came
amazing.
Out of the womb bald. I imagine James came out as if this is becoming the James Dyer podcast, but I imagine he comes out fully formed. I know, he's not here. He's not famous. He just works for Empire, but we're going to dedicate the next 5 minutes to James Dyer.
Okay.
I imagine he came out 6'2", bald, mm-hmm. being incredibly self-righteous and intelligent and smart and brilliant and funny and a right pain in the ass. Immediately.
It was a difficult labour.
His mum was
still
furious.
Is.
In many ways, he still is a man child. Yeah, I really like the Wolverine hair. Thumbs up for the Wolverine hair. Days of Future Past hair. Now, which one?
I think 70s rather than future for me. And there's not a huge amount in it, obviously, because they had to... But there's a little bit of squarishness about the Days of Future Past hair, isn't there? There's an element of squared offness, which I'm not sure. It's not bad, and it's still very high on top in the 70s. Like really, like it definitely has those peaks. It has the victory rolls still.
Yeah, I like the bits of grey at the temples for future Wolverine. That's pretty good. And I think that answers our question: who cuts his hair? And it has to be him. It has to be him because there are no barbers in post-apocalyptic wasteland in the 1970s, as we all know. That's why all the footballers looked like that. And in the 2023, there were no barbers around because they were all killed.
I guess he just pops one claw, maybe the one by the little finger, to get as close to the head as possible.
Yeah.
Just run it backwards and then run it across the top.
Yeah.
And Bob's your uncle.
Yeah. And now I'll do you, Charles. Fuck off. Get away from me with those. No. But then Magneto could control the claws for precision.
Wow.
What a team.
Yeah. What a team.
Mags and Logan's Barbershop.
So then what we get into is some kind of like Edward Scissorhands kind of creation sort of hair designs, where Logan could really reinvent himself as a heck of a in-demand hairdresser.
This
he could be
amazing.
The sort of John Peters of the mutant universe.
There's a shocking... Wasn't Joel Schumacher a hairdresser as well?
Was he?
Or something like that. Didn't he start off as a costume designer or a hairdresser?
Oh my God. I'm sure he would
love to hear that.
Joel, if you're listening, and I know you are, do write in and let us know. So he appears in First Class for one scene. There's his hair.
You see, this is kind of rockabilly-esque... Very 50s greaser. Grease 1, not Grease 2, even though Grease 2 is a superior film, but that's a completely different discussion. I like this. This for me has an air of sexy.
An air of sexy.
Unlike all the others, of course, which are hideous.
Which leave me cold.
This was one scene, of course, and he had to compete with the sexiness levels of Fassbender and McAvoy. And it's set in 1962, so that would... explain the 50s-ness of it, but he had to bring it. He had to bring the sexy hair, and I think he did in that one. All right.
Looks like Johnny Depp in Crybaby. Sorry, that just entered my head, and I had to shout it.
Yeah,
he
does
a little bit.
He does a little bit.
Does,
yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, he does. Right. So what's next? X-Men Apocalypse. His brief cameo in that, where his hair is just wild and just
wild
split ends everywhere.
I can't. Give Apocalypse full marks for anything. Sorry.
Poor Apocalypse seems to come towards the bottom or second bottom of all X-Men polls. And
I think it might do
here as well.
I've already talked at length about the hair sins committed vis-a-vis Oscar Isaac in Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. So, I'm going to try not to do that again. But, like, come on, people. You can't do that. The thing with Apocalypse is the crazy sort of halo around his head. So you can't even see what the hair is doing in that, except that his beard is really unkempt.
When Jean takes it off and lets the helmet fall to the ground. And, it's the first time Jean touched Wolverine's helmet.
Oh, Chris. Anyway, and then we have Logan, where his own hair... There's a little bit of colour variation I noticed throughout. Sometimes it looks almost blonde.
Mm-hmm.
You're still thinking about that joke, aren't you?
Yeah. pretty happy with that one.
I know, Chris. Yeah, there's a little bit of kind of colour variation. He kind of carries off the grizzled look quite well, I think. And but I think X-24's hair is the superior Wolverine hair in that film.
This is interesting.
100%. That buzz cut.
Yeah, it's working for him. I'll just give Terry a moment.
I'm formulating words, but they're currently inside my head and not coming out.
Has Hugh Jackman ever had a buzz cut on screen before? I don't know if he has he?
I feel like he has. I feel like I've seen that before.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm going to have to now go back through his filmography. What a trial.
One by one. Such a chore. I'm surprised he didn't go for the peaks. And if you want to go, if X-24 is the apotheosis of Logan, I should have had massive hair. He should have had 10 feet tall hair that people would be able to hide in and hang off. Because sometimes you see in the comic books some of the hair that the artists will, you know, they'll have artistic license, obviously, being artists, and they'll go absolutely nuts with the hair. I think they should have done that with X-24.
Like
instead
Pat
of your
Benatar.
Sexy buzz cut.
Pat Benatar hair.
Pat Benatar, yes. So we've talked through in great excruciating detail for the four people who are still listening to this. Let's rank them very, very quickly.
Okay.
Best hair.
Oh, I'm going to be controversial and say X-Men Origins Wolverine.
First class. I know it's one scene, but it's okay. First class.
The Wolverine.
The Wolverine is good. Wolverine might be my number two.
Wait. Days of Future Past.
Okay. Those can be the first three. I don't know.
Days of Future Past. Okay. Next.
What's
bottom?
Two?
What's bottom?
Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Apocalypse?
Yeah.
Okay. Then by default.
Then X-1.
Okay.
Then probably X-3.
X-3, yeah.
Then X-2.
And then X-2, okay. Yeah. And where would you
put... And then Logan.
Logan.
Yeah, because
okay.
Logan, there's not much drama in the hair in Logan. Okay. It doesn't kind of stand alone. Out of the many things about that film that I love, I didn't, you know, have a hair moment.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? He's a man who's given up in Logan, so he's going to give up sort of maintaining his hairdo as well.
He does. It's a man who could do a blue-collar job, you know, there's bits of dust in his hair from the building site. This is a
rugged,
whole other fantasy world
rugged.
Where Logan works on a building site.
Shall we move on from this? All right, so I think it's pretty definitive. We all have different answers.
Amazing.
So that's settled your question. Strange person who sent in a question whose name I did not write down. So sorry about that. But hope you enjoyed part of us talking about it. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, and frankly, why wouldn't you? You can do so by sending them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and we are also on email, podcast@empireonline.com. Now seems a good time for a word about our sponsors three, who are, of course, also the sponsors of this year's Empire Awards. With three, you can use your phone abroad at no extra cost, whether you're on pay monthly advanced plans or pay as you go, no matter if you're using a tablet, a phone, or a dongle. I don't know what a dongle is, but if you want to use one, that's entirely up to you. Feel at Home works automatically. You'll receive a text message telling you you're in a feel at home destination when you arrive, and then you can use your phone completely worry free. And they tell you when you get back to the UK just how much money you've saved. And you can use that money to buy really frivolous things. Isn't that a lot of fun? Movie news. What is happening in the world of movie news this week?
Well, I mean, speaking of Hugh Jackman, which we always like to do, there was some casting news about him this week. Michael Mann has been trying for ages and ages to make a film about Enzo Ferrari, who was the car racing legend. That's what they tell me. I have no idea. I imagine he's in some way connected with Ferrari. He's been trying to make this biopic for ages and ages. He was going to make it a couple of years ago with Christian Bale. He dropped out, but the prestige has come to the rescue once again, and Hugh Jackman will step in instead, apparently with Noomi Rapace in the other lead role. So Mann has, as in Michael Mann, has two existing scripts. So one was by Troy Kennedy Martin, who wrote The Italian Job, another one by David Rayfield, who wrote Out of Africa. Mm-hmm. He's kind of put them together into a film called Ferrari, it's basically yeah, it's about 1 year in his life as he kind of begins his career working for Alfa Romeo as a racer, going to build his own company and building it into a force to be reckoned with. That's really it.
That's exciting.
So, because he's now, obviously, having done Wolverine, he no longer has to eat 4 chicken breasts and 6 raw eggs a day.
Yeah.
So I think it's The Guardian who reported that Christian Bale quit over the amount of weight he'd need to gain, which sounds unlikely. Ooh. For Christian Bale.
Yeah,
he's not exactly
like
a man who doesn't enjoy going full method.
He loves that stuff.
He loves it.
But then
he's Mr. Method Man.
That's what he says.
The only thing is, he did it like 3 times, really up and down between each Batman film. He had a hugely skinny role afterwards. There was that Prisoner of War movie,
The Machinist,
and
tons.
The Fighter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he lost huge amounts of weight for all of those, and it's possible. I mean, I certainly remember him talking at the time about how his doctor was a little bit worried about him, and he may have been advised not to massively change his body shape again. So I don't know.
Have we ever seen a fat Jackman?
I'm not sure we have.
I'm excited.
We're going to have to revisit all Hugh Jackman's films afterwards.
Ever happened.
Yeah. Even the bad ones. Like Someone Like You.
Hey, I really like Someone Like
really?
You.
Really? What about Deception? Is that the one with Ewan McGregor? Is that the one?
Was he?
He's an evil type.
I don't remember that one.
No.
Yeah. No? Yeah.
But it's the kind of name that doesn't exactly.
No,
stick.
It doesn't. It doesn't ring.
Okay. Anyway, so this could be happening.
I actually think Hugh Jackman's in a really interesting place coming off the back of Logan, because I think, you know, there is such an unfortunate, not stigma, but I think people judge stars who repeatedly are in comic book movies. You know, I know we've talked before about kind of sometimes how people don't give comic book movies the kudos really they deserve, and the actors the kudos they deserve. But I think Logan's taking him into a really different kind of dramatic space. And obviously he's still shooting Greatest Showman at the moment, which is musical, which is, you know, really his background. But to kind of see these other roles coming through, I'm really excited to see kind of the next 3 or 4 films he does. Because I think the kind of dramatic chops that he showed in Logan and that people really responded to and have shown him a lot of love for, I think is, I think it's kind of positioned him slightly different. It's a great way to move out of that character.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's always tried to do different things, but I think now he can really sort of do whatever he wants. Dagnabbit, which is great. Other slightly less likely casting news this week, Eva Green is going to be starring in the live action version of Dumbo, because certainly when I think flying elephants, I think Eva Green. Tim Burton obviously directing this, and she'll play one of the 3 main roles in the movie. We don't know what that means, because, you know, there aren't really 3 main human roles in Dumbo. I mean,
there
that's
are now.
It's a 70-minute film. I'm assuming that they're essentially doing what Disney have done with many of these live-action cartoon adaptations and kind of bulked out or extended or developed the story a bit more. So maybe that's where she's kind of fitting in, or maybe she's voicing Dumbo's mum. I have no idea. But Eva Green in Dumbo, which is still a thing that's happening.
Yeah, clearly that's a partnership that works. She was the best thing about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
She was.
She's very good in Dark Shadows.
Yes, very good.
So, well done.
I hope this kind of, and obviously if this works out, becomes a great kind of long relationship between those two, because I completely agree with Chris. I had many issues with Miss Peregrine's, but I thought she was absolutely spectacular.
She is
she
terrific.
She was captivating.
Yeah.
And I felt like he brought something out in her that I'd not really seen before, so I'm
there's a kind
really
of impishness to her in his films, I think. Yeah, I agree.
There's a real twinkle in her eye.
But it's just, I'm still slightly baffled by the whole live action Dumbo brought to you by Tim Burton. Of course, though, Tim Burton has a background in animation, worked for Disney in the 80s before going into sort of live action filmmaking, and almost every animator I've ever met worships Dumbo, so I guess that's probably why this is happening. It still seems like a slightly old film.
I think one thing about Tim Burton's Dumbo is that it's not going to be a slavish remake in the way that perhaps other live-action movie adaptations of Disney movies have been. Or it's not going to necessarily just cling to the contours of the original. I think that's very interesting. He's going to do his own thing, and that thing is going to be batshit insane. And I'm on board. It's very exciting.
But can we just say live-action elephant?
I know. Well, this is the problem with using the phrase live action about some of these films, because we're talking about a live action Lion King, which is not remotely what we're going to get. And live action Jungle Book was not either. It's a confusing time, and I don't know how to talk about it.
It's a confusing time. It's a strange time. We never really talked about the Lion King, the casting decisions that Jon Favreau has made in the Lion King. So Donald Glover is Simba.
Yeah.
Cool. Very, very cool. Donald Glover's having a real moment at the moment. And I love this. James Earl Jones as Mufasa.
I mean, if it ain't broke.
I mean, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
He can do Darth Vader again. He can do Mufasa again. It's all very, very exciting. It's got to be Jeremy Irons.
Field
Scar,
of Dreams remake. Come on.
Yeah. But how many times has that happened where an actor has had a chance to play the same part in a remake? Maybe that's a question for next week, people. Listen to that and send it in.
We also have news about a former pod guest this week. Very big, very exciting news about a pod guest.
Who is it?
Jason Isaacs. Hello to him.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
He will be the captain of Star Trek Discovery, the return of Star Trek to the small screen, which is extraordinarily welcome after too long a break. And he will be,
He will be killed in episode 4.
That's my
guess. Or evil.
No.
One of the two.
No.
He would be killed in episode 4. He'll
You're
be like
evil.
The big, shocking Sean Bean in Game of Thrones death that you didn't think was coming. Ooh, look what it is coming. It's Lisa Faulkner in Spooks with her face being shoved into the boiling fat.
Ew.
It's going to happen. Jason Isaacs, he's going to be bad or killed. Mark my words.
Well, okay, look, I don't want in any way to join you in that level of cynicism, Chris.
It's not cynicism.
However, I will admit that they have said that the captain is not central to the show in the way that, for example, a Captain Picard, a Captain Janeway, a Captain Kirk, or a
Captain
Commander
Expendable.
Sisko initially are.
Captain coughing into a handkerchief and looking at spots of blood.
How dare you, sir?
Yeah.
How dare
That's his
you?
Name. It's an unusual name, but...
So Isaacs obviously joins Doug Jones, Anthony Rapp, James Frain, Michelle Yeoh is going to be recurring. The lead is going to be Sonequa Martin-Green as Rainsford, who's the sort of number one figure, the Riker, if you will, the number one in the cage, if you go back right back to the pilot. You know, that guy.
That lady.
So, exciting times. It's now going to be late summer/early autumn. And it's going to be Netflix, I think, in this part of the world.
Good casting. Good casting from Jason Isaacs as doomed captain.
Oi!
So what do you think? What do you make of this Jared Leto Tron reboot that's in the works, apparently? What do we think of that?
Yeah, I guess.
What do you think of Liam Neeson in Talks? I think we give that the shrift it deserved. What do you think of Liam Neeson in Talks to join Steve McQueen's Widows? That's good. That's exciting.
Yeah. It's about time Liam Neeson did something that wasn't, you know, running around with a gun. I'm excited.
I imagine this might involve running around with a gun. I've just got a sneaking suspicion. He even tried it in Monster Calls. I've got my own gun. No, it's fine, Liam. It's okay. It's a tree. He doesn't have a gun. He must have a gun.
Getting back to Hugh Jackman, which I obviously like to do as often as possible, there was sad news this week when Larrikins, which is the Australian musical animation that he's been working up with, scheduled to appear in with Naomi Watts and Margot Robbie, has been basically mothballed. It has been killed, apparently, by Chris Meledandri, who's taken over DreamWorks Animation and culled a bunch of projects in development, which is a shame because this was Tim Minchin's film and he was writing all the songs for it. Remember when I had breakfast with Hugh Jackman, he was raving about how good the songs were and he was really excited about it and very excited to be working with Minchin, who was going to co-direct as well as composing, and I'm sure it would have been funny and obviously musically brilliant, so that's kind of sad news, and I hope it finds a home somewhere else in some other form.
Indeed. A little bit more news to talk about. So Vanessa Kirby, who was excellent as Princess Margaret in The Crown season 1, has joined the cast of Mission Impossible 6.
Ooh.
That's exciting. It says here her role will be on the same level as Rebecca Ferguson in Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, but Ferguson is expected to return alongside Simon Pegg and Jeremy Renner and some guy called Cruzy Mapother, I think that's his name. And I'm excited about this. Starts filming next month in Paris with our good pod friend Christopher McQuarrie at the helm.
Fabian.
So all very, very exciting. I saw yesterday in the street Solomon Lane himself, Sean Harris, walking down Old Compton Street as if he didn't have a care in the world. Wow. He's eluded IMF's clutches.
Not for long, Chris.
Not for long.
I was driving past Bank in a bus on Sunday, and there was a bunch of people filming there, and I think it was Mary Poppins Returns.
It will be. Yeah. They're here.
So we've seen some images from that, haven't we? They released an image of Emily Blunt.
They did.
You couldn't see her face, so you didn't know what she looks like. She looks like Emily Blunt.
In the greatest coat I've seen since Newt Scamander. That sounds like damning with faint praise, but honestly, a great coat. I want them both. I want those coats.
It was a good coat. And didn't they release an image of your bloke?
They did.
Your mate.
Yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Linny.
No.
Manny?
No.
Linny Manny.
No, still no. Lighting lamps, which is his job in the film. He is not a chimney sweep. He is a lamp
what
lighter.
Do you think his Cockney accent's going to be?
I think it'll be excellent if he's doing a Cockney accent, which I'm not sure
what?
He is.
Governor? I'm not going to throw away my shot, so I'm not.
That's amazing. You've learned a line.
And Dick Van Dyke will be on hand if he needs any help finessing.
He will be.
That Dick, accent.
You know, Dick Van Dyke, this is true. Dick Van Dyke has in his house in LA his own studio with a green screen, and he's banging into special effects stuff, and he has all the latest programs, and so he fiddles around with this stuff. So I think for 30, maybe 50 years now, Dick Van Dyke has been filming himself trying to get the Cockney accent right. When he comes back on set of Mary Poppins Returns, it's going to be like one of the Mitchell brothers.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. I
His
hope
first,
so.
Poppins, you can't.
I think I can guarantee that line won't be in it.
Let me finish the sentence. Poppins, you can't do that, Mary. Poppins.
Oh god.
That's what I said. Can't. You can't do anyway, I'll come in again. That's what he's going to say.
91. It took to 91 for him to nail the accent.
To nail the accent. That, Terry, that wasn't him. That was me.
Oh my
pretending
gosh.
To be him.
Oh my gosh. This is like a play within a play within a play.
We need to have a talk about how movies are made.
Spielberg. Can you just do me a crib sheet? That'd be
great. Spielberg's making a movie with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep.
I'm sorry?
Spielberg's making a movie with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep.
This is amazing. When do I go on set? I want it.
It's a timely story about the importance of a free press. And it's called The Post. And it'll focus on the 1971 scandal after the decision of Ben Bradley, played by Tom Hanks. He of course, was also played by Jason Robards in All the President's Men.
Yep.
And his son...
John Slattery in Spotlight.
In Spotlight. And publisher Catherine Graham Streep to publish the Pentagon Papers, which established that the Johnson administration had lied to the public and Congress about US military involvement in the Vietnam War. Well, I cannot see why that's timely.
It's so mysterious.
It's so weird. But
so hang on, Steven Spielberg's making this.
He's making this.
Before Ready Player One or after?
After Ready Player One, which is wrapped.
And of course.
He's in post on that. So I imagine this is his next thing because, of course, this week as well, they confirmed that Indiana Jones 5 is going to be coming in 2019.
Yes.
So that'll be, I imagine he'll do the post and then go into post in the post, and he'll be doing prep on Indy, the fourth Indy film.
So he'll be prepping Indy as he posts the post.
Yeah, he'll be posting the post, and that's all she wrote, because I don't think there's any more wordplay to be wrung from that.
I am 100% there. I'm 110% there for this film.
I'm excited. It's been a good week for movie news. Well done, movie news. Give yourself a round of applause. I've got some bad movie news.
Oh,
no! Helen!
I'm sorry, but Joe Carnahan has left Bad Boys for Life, Chris.
And the bad movie news...
Okay, well, maybe bad is a strong word. But he did write the most recent version of the script. It seemed to be coming together, and he's apparently
I think this is a good move for Joe Carnahan. I like Joe Carnahan as a director, and I don't want him to hitch his wagon to terrible movies.
Hey, we don't know that. It could be.
We have no evidence, you're absolutely right, that a Bad Boys film would be terrible. You're right.
I, for one, am excited. When I was 17, I loved Bad Boys.
The first one?
Yes.
The second one is just...
I mean,
the second one's pretty bad.
There's obviously a progression of quality in the wrong direction. And it is funny because I don't think anybody's saying, he's decided to leave the project. It's like Bad Boy 3, losers director. It's like, yeah, you did.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, you did.
And then one last thing, I think we're happy about this, aren't we? Lars von Trier's back. He's back.
Of course.
On a serial killer thriller called The House That Jack Built, which answers a question I've seriously been asking myself for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I've nearly gone on Twitter several times to ask, what the hell is Matt Dillon doing these days?
Well, I think we've all wondered that, Chris.
And yes. The answer is, he's starring as a serial killer who's hacking his way through swathes of characters in the 1970s in The House That Jack Built. And those characters would include the likes of Riley Keough and Sophie Grable. And Uma Thurman. So
it's also the name of a Aretha Franklin song. Very good one.
I wonder if they know that.
Probably.
I imagine they do.
Yeah, probably.
I think he'd be an excellent serial killer.
Who?
Matt Dillon.
Oh, I thought you meant Lars von Trier.
Oh, yeah. No, why would I say that? Why would I say that, Chris? No, Matt Dillon. Matt Dillon would be an excellent fictional serial killer.
We cannot stress that enough.
Fictional serial killer.
Serial killer. I'm excited. Lars von Trier coming back. It was planned as an 8-part TV series. Now they're going to turn it into a film, and its shooting started this week. So it's a good week.
It's a good just very quickly before, because we do have to move on eventually.
We do have to talk about other things.
Anna Faris is starring in an Overboard remake. Now, obviously, Overboard is perfect and should never be remade, but if you're going to, I feel like she is not a bad shout for the Goldie Hawn role. So I'm okay with that. The bigger question is, Eugenio Derbez is on to star in the sort of Kurt Russell role, and I have to confess I haven't seen very much of his stuff, so I don't know how good he's going to be.
Do you want to see? Passed me by as well. He has 8.9 million Twitter followers. I checked this out the other day when I clicked on his Twitter handle. 8.9 million.
That's only slightly less than you.
It is only slightly less than me at 10.4 million. Anna Faris. I hope this doesn't derail her podcast, which is excellent. Anna Faris is unqualified. If you haven't heard that, it's very, very good.
It's very good.
I think, honestly, because that film does stand up. From a comedic perspective, that film does stand up, as does Goldie's performance. I think she is absolutely the right person to take it on.
A falsetto child.
Oh, God.
So good. Speaking of cool blondes news, Margot Robbie will be starring in a Maid Marian film, which is apparently pitched somewhere along the lines of Game of Thrones. Now, there is only one Maid Marian that makes sense to me, and that is, of course, Maid Marian and Her Merry Men. So I'm a little bit disturbed by this change in tone that they seem to be planning. But, you know, we can only hope that Tony Robinson turns up as the Sheriff of Nottingham.
I'm sure it'll happen.
Oh, please make it so.
Anyway,
that's enough for the movie news. Should we talk about Wolverine's hair a little bit more, or should we have a guest?
Let's have a guest.
So our guest this week is one of our favourite pod regulars. He's challenging Simon Pegg for the greatest number of appearances in the podcast. I think this is his fourth now, maybe his third, but you know, it feels like he's in a lot.
Good to see.
Which is good, because we like him. He's a brilliant actor, and all-round nice guy to boot. This week, he stops Thor bothering long enough to play a British mercenary who goes to Skull Island, and there he finds more than he bargained for in the shape of a very big ape in Kong Skull Island. It is, of course, the brilliant Tom Hiddleston, and he was talking to John Nugent. Do enjoy.
We are very delighted to have Tom Hiddleston back on the Empire Podcast. Welcome, sir. How are you?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm very good. This is a pleasure. Always love doing this.
Yeah, I think this is your third time.
Is it the third or is it the second?
I believe it's the third.
Yeah, it's the third, yeah.
So the last time we had you on, you serenaded Chris for...
I saw the light, that's right, yes.
So...
Yes, I did.
I have a lot to live up to, basically.
I haven't got a guitar in here, I'm afraid.
That's okay. So... we're here to talk about Kong Skull Island,
yes.
Of course. We've seen Tom Hiddleston, the bad guy, the Tom Hiddleston, the super spy, Tom Hiddleston, the vampire, the musician, the baronet, but we've never seen Tom Hiddleston, the action hero. Was that part of the appeal?
Yeah, I suppose so. It was when I was asked to be in the film, it was described as an old-fashioned adventure of the kind of, you know, similar to those films that I loved growing up, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Jurassic Park, with a contemporary twist and with your favourite prehistoric movie ape in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And Captain James Conrad, my character, is a former soldier, Special Forces, handy with survival skills in the jungle, handy with a sharp object, and it was just very different from everything I'd ever done before, and and jumped at it.
And my colleague Nick from Empire, he joined you for stretches of filming.
Yeah, he came to every place.
Yeah, and you went to some pretty amazing places like Vietnam and Hawaii and Australia. I mean, that's okay, yeah, I guess.
It's a tough gig.
Yeah.
They were amazing.
Yeah.
And for two reasons. One, there's a version of this film which is shot on a soundstage in a studio with a few well-placed pot plants, and it's probably easier for the transport and everybody like that. But we went to these places and Oahu in Hawaii, Queensland in Australia, and Vietnam at least provided everyone, not just the actors but also the crew, with sun, wind, real swamps, volcanoes, mountains, weather, so that it felt like we were all actually on this deserted island. The only thing we had to imagine was Kong. And the second thing is just the privilege of getting to visit these places. They are so, I think it helped all of us kind of become a band together as a company. There's nothing like throwing a bunch of actors in the valley of a volcano in Hawaii on the second day to be like, okay, you guys just get along. Loved it.
What did you have a favorite location and a least favorite location? Could you pick those two out?
I have a soft spot for Hawaii because we shot from October to December in Hawaii, and so Thanksgiving weekend in America fell in our shooting dates, and it's a big holiday in America. But I didn't come home to London because it was too far, and we only had 4 days off. Everybody else, all our American actors and crew, went home. So I stayed in Hawaii and I learned to surf.
Oh, wow.
In Waikiki Beach. I'd never been surfing. I've always wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And the waves are very gentle for beginners like me, and I got up on the first day and was addicted after that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of always going to be special. And then in Australia, I was reunited with my on-screen brother, Chris Hemsworth. I hadn't seen him in a while, so that was nice. And then in Vietnam itself was just the most breathtakingly beautiful place I've ever seen. I can't recommend a trip highly enough. It's so unspoiled, and the people are so warm and welcoming. And there's this great time. I wasn't filming. It was a scene with Samuel L. Jackson and his crew, and Corey Hawkins, who plays Brooks and is now starring in the new 24, and Thomas Mann, who you might know from Me and Earl and The Dying Girl.
Yes.
They knocked on my door and said, "We've got the day off. We found this huge cave. The only way to get there is by zip line. And you have to," so you wear your swimming trunks and a life jacket, and you get on this zip line and you jump into the river, and then you have to swim into the ocean and into the mouth of the cave, and then you can, bathe in these rock pools and stuff. So that felt like a real adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you say, you're kind of, you have these amazing locations, but you are acting against, presumably a tennis ball on a stick for King
Kong? Too tall for tennis balls.
Okay.
Brie Larson, who I was mostly standing next to, we would pick the top of a tree or a cloud in the sky or a mountaintop and work out the eye line with the camera operator. And the rest of it is pure imagination. Just have to imagine it.
And is it when you watch it on screen for the first time and you're seeing things that were not there on location? I mean, what is that feeling like? Is it like sort of an imaginary friend just coming to life?
It is incredible. Especially because we spent 5 months, and you spent 5 months trying to conceive of this thing, and then you see them. I say them, it's Kong plus others.
Yeah.
And even if it's just the water buffalo, it is incredible. It's like to be in the frame with these creatures that have only existed in your mind. It's really an amazing thing.
Yeah.
It's familiar. It feels familiar from the Marvel stuff. Because that's so often in those scenes, I'm physically present on set, but the Hulk isn't there and Iron Man isn't flying in the, around in the sky.
Right.
So, yeah, there is a kind of childlike delight in seeing it all come together.
I read somewhere that yourself and Samuel L. Jackson and Brie Larson were nicknamed the three Vietnamigos.
Yes, that's the Sam Jackson coinage.
Okay, that's pretty good.
yeah.
I mean, is there like a Spirit of the Trenches thing from an experience like this that you sort of go through stuff that only you can truly appreciate?
Like, I think just, you know, when you have a big experience like this, it's kind of incomparable with any other, then you always share that. And ultimately, it felt like a great adventure. Of course, it had its challenges, as any adventure does, and it was quite physical and running through a swamp every day for 10 days isn't you know, that's about as many days as you'd want to do it.
Yeah, the 11th day. Yeah,
you're like, nah,
forget
I'm
about
not getting
it.
In the swamp yeah. ever again. But yeah, so I think when you share those experiences and the kind of the madness of it, that it does, you know, Sam was saying the other night, when you're having to imagine all these creatures and, you know, he would always say, what is it? How big is it? Where is it? How fast is it? and it does feel kind of, it does feel mad sometimes.
Yeah.
But it all worked out in the end.
And of course, you know, the three Vietnamigos, you, Sam and Brie, are in another universe. You're in the MCU together.
Yeah.
I mean, you and Sam are the Marvel veterans, I suppose, and Brie is the newcomer. Did you have any sort of advice for her on joining this sort of mad universe?
Yeah, actually, she was cast after we finished. Mm. And I think the experience of making this is probably going to help her with the, you know, as I say, living in your own imagination to some extent, and all the green screen work. But she has brought so many of her own ideas to the table, which I think Kevin Feige and all the guys at Marvel are really excited about. So I'm just excited to see what she brings. She's so intelligent and curious and investigative, and I get the impression Captain Marvel is not going to be messed with easily.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you going to get to share any scenes with her? I mean,
I don't know. Okay. I'm not like
being... You can blink once if you
couldn't possibly. Still the God of Mischief after all.
Yes. staying in Marvel, we all watched Doctor Strange last year and saw.
God, it was great, wasn't it?
So good.
So good. I saw it in. It was the. We were about to wrap Thor Ragnarok, and Kevin Feige flew over to the set and he screened it for the entire crew. So I think we saw it 2 weeks before it was released, or a week before. And I said to him, I think it's the best.
Okay.
And I think this is the best one they've made.
Yeah. Did you know that the post-credit scene was going to be there?
I did.
You did?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So are we going to see Loki team up with Doctor Strange by any chance? Are you going to get to share scenes with your old pal Benedict?
To answer the first part of the question, I'm not sure team up is the correct verb.
Okay.
In that sentence.
Okay. We can infer from that.
Okay, so I'll just leave it there.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. I did just want to quickly ask about Early Man, which obviously starring in this is Aardman's next movie.
Yeah.
Is it, after doing all these huge films where you're going around the world and these crazy locations against a lot of green screen some of the time, is it nice to come back to England and sit in a recording studio with a sort of almost painfully slow and incredibly English film like Early Man?
Like Early Man.
And just drink lots of tea, I imagine.
Yes, lots of tea is drunk in that studio.
Yeah.
I have had so much fun making it. Nick Park is one of the funniest men I've ever had the company of being around. There was maybe it was my first session committing my character, the voice of my character, to tape for the first time. He made me laugh so much that we actually had to stop the recording session because I couldn't continue.
Oh, wow.
And I had to have a break and go outside and calm down and come back in again because he will go further in pursuit of a good joke than anyone I think I've ever met. Yeah. He's relentless, and that unique Aardman sense of humour is right at the fore.
Yeah, you do hear, for some people, recording animation audio is quite a hard process. Like, it's quite sort of long and tedious. Have you found that at all? Is it been difficult?
No, it's definitely, it requires precision.
Yeah.
Because you want to give the animators as much material to use as possible. Yeah. And also because you're doing it in advance of their work, you know there are so many decisions that are going to be made after the fact. So you want to give them choices.
Yeah.
And my character is bonkers. I can't reveal too much, but you'll see exactly how bonkers he is.
Okay.
But it's good fun.
Okay, well, we look forward to that. Yeah. Just very quickly.
You know what it's about, right?
Yes. Yeah. Cavemen.
Cavemen.
Yes.
Just muddling along, trying to invent things.
Yeah.
It's just shot through with a very traditionally British sense of humour. It's very dry.
I think almost out of time. I just wanted to ask, this is something we do occasionally at Empire. We do the IMDb bunker.
Where we
look at your IMDb page and look at the trivia, and then we fact check it, basically.
Let's do it. Yes.
Because, you know, 95% of what's on the internet is just totally untrue.
That's right.
So in the era of fake news, let's get to the truth. So first of all, an easy one. Is your favourite film Heat?
It's one of my favourite films.
Okay.
It's a film I really love. It's just great.
Okay.
I saw it at a particular time in my life, and it's just always never disappoints when I rewatch it. Do you like it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Classic. Absolute classic.
Yeah.
The scene with De Niro and Pacino.
That's what acting is all about.
That is it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the scene.
Yeah.
When I was at drama school, I already loved the film, but my acting teacher would direct us all to go and see it because it's such a perfect depiction of stakes. And that drama is actually all about high stakes.
Yeah.
But Pacino and De Niro don't play the stakes. They try to undercut the stakes,
yeah,
which is why it's so good, because they're just having a drink.
Yeah, yeah.
When really they should, you know. They spent the whole film chasing each other. Anyway, I could get lost in the whole interview. Yeah.
Okay. Next one. Favorite superhero is Superman.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. Because he's the first one I remember.
Okay.
As played by Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That first film still holds up.
Yeah.
It's got such wit and humanity in it.
Okay, how about this? Do you speak French, Spanish, Italian, Greek, and Latin?
Okay, let's take them one by one. My French is okay.
Yeah.
My Spanish is not as good as my French.
Yeah.
But I do speak it.
Okay.
Si je visite France, je pense que c'est assez facile à communiquer avec le monde. En español entiendo más que hablo, pero entiendo poquito. Italiano, no.
Okay.
No, I don't have any Italian, really. I can read it.
Yes.
And the reason I can read it is because I studied Latin and Greek at university, so I can read ancient Greek and Latin, but don't ask me to speak it, because they're dead languages.
Okay. All right.
Does that answer your question?
That does, comprehensively.
Okay.
One last one, very quickly. I'm just going to read out what is written on IMDb.
You
can tell me if it's wrong.
All right.
His eyes water involuntarily when he is spooked.
Oh, that's true.
That's true?
Yeah. I think Jessica Chastain revealed that to the world.
Okay.
yes.
So what happens? You're frightened, and then you start.
So some people, the hairs on the back of their neck stand up, or they get the shivers or the chills.
Yes.
And if you were to tell me a really great ghost story, or if something real went bump in the night. I'm watching a terrifying film.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the last time that happened. Name a scary film that's came out recently.
It Follows, maybe?
I didn't see that.
You didn't see that?
No.
Under the Skin. And,
yeah, definitely. That was. But I actually found that just enthralling.
Yeah.
But mostly if I watch horror films, I get... the manifestation of fear is that my eyes will water.
Wow.
I have no idea why.
I've never
it doesn't mean I'm actually
before.
Crying.
Yeah.
It's not emotive, it's not emotionally motivated. It's just a sort of...
Involuntary
thing.
Wow. Well, on that note, okay. Tom Hiddleston, thank you so much for your
thank
time.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, so that was Tom Hiddleston, star of Kong Skull Island, and here to talk about Kong Skull Island and tell you whether it's worth your wonga.
Oh.
Skull Island is Helen.
Hello, it's me.
Hey.
So this is a slightly unusual take on Kong, first of all, because... it's set in the 1970s. And it's in the final days of the Vietnam War. So an organization called Monarch, which is part of the US government, has basically discovered this island through recently released satellite images. And they're like, look, as soon as the war ends, the Russians are going to start getting into this place as well. So we don't want to let them get into this unexplored land. Who knows what incredible wealth there may be lying beneath its surface. We've got to go in there first. So they basically co-opt a helicopter squadron, charter a ship, get in a jungle fighting expert in the shape of Tom Hiddleston, and for some reason bring along a photojournalist in the shape of Brie Larson, and head to this unexplored point. Things don't go quite according to plan. Their scientific methods, and I'm not kidding, include dropping napalm on the jungle, just, you know, to see what happens, shits and giggles. And this is taken amiss by a gigantic ape living on the island. That is, of course, King Kong. And he basically brings down all the helicopters. So then we have a scattered group of people trying to find their way to safety through an extremely hostile environment where bugs are roughly the size of houses, quite large houses on stilts.
Mm. It's like
water buffalo
in Australia.
Yeah, water buffalo, like something out of a Miyazaki fever dream, are roughly the size of, you know, six double-decker buses stacked up. And there's Kong running around just stepping on things. There's also worse monsters called skull crawlers, at least by John C. Reilly, who plays a World War II pilot who was stranded on the island 28 years before and has gone a little bit doolally in the meantime. So Kong basically keeps the skull crawler population down and is kind of therefore not maybe as bad as he initially seems, because they're really horrible. That's kind of it.
Thank you for finding the plot in this film.
There's a lot going on. There is a lot going on. And there's huge scattered groups of people all trying to fight for sort of screen time. There is one character, and I'm not going to say who, but he might as well be called Dead Meat Thompson, because like he is 100, he's more doomed than you think Jason Isaacs is in Star Trek Discovery, let me tell you.
In fact, he was originally played by Jason Isaacs.
And you know, it's so there's times when the human drama, I think, fails, which is kind of surprising, because Jordan Vogt Roberts, the director, came from, you know, a really strong indie film background. And if anything, usually in that circumstance, it's the action that suffers. In this case, the action is fine. It's the human drama that I think sometimes gets lost between all of the gigantic monsters.
Yeah, I mean, I visually thought it was pretty incredible. Actually, it's really lush. It's the jungle is rendered. The island is rendered really beautifully. I thought Kong was incredibly impressive, but the kind of hunt for some human story at the heart of this, or just a single arc that you can follow and kind of be compelled by, is very, very, very tricky. And that ultimately is the film's biggest failing, I think, because I was kind of, when I was watching it, you come in and out, you're kind of taken in by a little melodrama or kind of unfolding on screen, and then it doesn't kind of thread through to anything. So it's kind of a series of little set pieces without an overarching story, which is just incredibly bad. After 2 hours, you're like, okay, I understand, this is fine. And from a character point of view, everybody did fine, but yeah. nobody really had a chance to shine or to have a properly developed character. I really wanted to know people's backstories, their motivations.
Yeah.
She's a photojournalist. Tell me, you know, as a woman, as a photojournalist in that situation, that must be a challenge. Why has she done it? How has she got there? Why are you there? so there was a lot of why questions that didn't get answered by this film. But I enjoy, you know, it's you can go and you can have a rollicking good time. Mm. It's kind of mindless in some ways. But I think it just doesn't have that kind of narrative thread that pulls you through and holds you for the entire film.
Yeah, I had a lot of why questions after watching Kong Skull Island, which we'll explore maybe a little bit more in our spoiler special, which is coming up next week. It's going to be available on Monday. What is Monday? What date is Monday?
The 13th.
Monday the 13th. We're going to have Jordan Fox Roberts talking about it as well as some of us talking about the film. You know, it's a fine, okay monster movie, has some decent set pieces. Of course, we should talk about how this movie originated, and it originated as a way of reintroducing King Kong so that ultimately he will fight Godzilla. Which is a movie that's already been announced for 2020. Mm. So this is a bigger Kong than
we've
seen before.
After another Godzilla in the meantime.
Yes, Godzilla 2, which is just about to start filming with Michael Dougherty as the writer director in that one. That's got my interest. This one kind of left me a bit cold, but it has decent spectacle.
Yeah, I would say I would kind of agree with all that. I think Larson and Hiddleston should have had more to do because they're both so good when they are given anything to work with.
But this is a problem when you're dealing with, and again, we'll spoil it, especially this a little bit more, but this is a problem when you're dealing with Godzilla or Kong, who are so big
that
the human characters have to have something about them so that they matter.
I think there's an interesting contrast to be made, which I'm sure we will, between this and the 2005 King Kong, mm-hmm. Which obviously gave itself an extra hour just to try and develop the human characters a bit more. And I think, you know, if you're going to have this many human characters, and there are huge numbers in this film, then I think maybe you needed a little more time. However, the other thing I would say to everybody is do stay through the credits. There is quite an important post-credit sting that explains or at least alludes to lots of stuff that will be important later. So
I couldn't believe they got Hugh Jackman back as well.
I know, and when Samuel L. Jackson broke character to appear as Nick Fury, etc.
When people start turning up in other companies' movies. Anyway, 3 stars then for Kong Skull Island, which, as we always say in the Empire Podcast, is of course a recommendation. And next up, we have the return of arch provocateur Paul Verhoeven. He's back with Elle, a movie for which Isabelle Huppert received an Oscar nomination. Terry, this is a bit of a button pusher, this one, isn't it?
It is, and you would expect so from Verhoeven. So essentially, as you say, it's Isabelle Huppert. I am going to, by the way, before we get into this, embarrass myself with my French pronunciation. So feel free to laugh at will. But Isabelle Huppert, who plays a boss of a video game company, and essentially the film opens with her attack. You kind of hear the attack and then you start to see bits of it, and she's being assaulted essentially after a man in a mask breaks into her home and rapes her. And immediately you know you're in different territory, because she doesn't act like a perceived victim. She doesn't report it to the police. She's quite a caustic character. It doesn't seem to touch her. She goes about her daily business. She continues work at her job in this video games company. And it's essentially it's not a typical rape revenge thriller, which often in and of themselves are kind of laced with misogyny and are incredibly problematic. But it's very much about, she gets taunted by her attacker, and then it's about her trying to essentially unmask this guy. And it's an interesting one, because I think I'm quite alone in how I feel about this film, in that I think it's, from a filmmaking perspective, it's exceptional. She is absolutely incredible and arguably deserved an Oscar for that performance. It's a remarkable turn from her, because she manages to play kind of, she's a victim, but she's also a manipulator. She is passive in some scenarios, but also in control in so much of it. The dark and light in her character is handled incredibly.
Yeah.
However, I have huge problems with this film, which is, I think there is such a difficult line between coercion and force and consent. And I think those lines are really blurred in this film. And I think anybody who's ever kind of experienced any kind of sexual violence or anything like that will struggle with the kind of masochistic pleasure she seems to get on some level from the violence. They keep revisiting the attack scene, and in it there is definitely, I certainly perceived a sense that there was a level of physical enjoyment that she was getting. So I found the kind of the sexual politics messaging around this film really difficult, because I think there has to be a bit of a clearer dialogue about consent and about rape. But that said, I think lots of other people, and I think Helen, you're one of them, kind of see it as being quite subversive and see it as actually about taking control in that situation. And I mean, it breaks convention in so many ways. I don't think it's set out to be a film that deliberately goes after a different narrative with rape. I think it's Verhoeven, so I think it's meant to be muddy and difficult, yeah, and challenging in all those ways, which it is. But yeah, that fundamentally sat at the heart of the film for me as kind of a problematic thing.
I actually kind of agree entirely that that's there, and I think it made me very uncomfortable, and I didn't like it in some ways. I think what was interesting, and the reason I'm slightly more up on the film generally, is that I think that the assault that we see at the beginning is definitely non-consensual and is definitely a rape and is extraordinarily upsetting to watch as a result. And I think that the way she deals with it is so completely unconventional and completely not the way you're supposed to react that I find that just interesting. And I find it just... it made me think a lot about what we expect of each other and of ourselves and of, you know, quote unquote victims and quote unquote survivors. And I think it's made very clear as the film unfolds that this woman has extraordinary circumstances in her background that make her react in the bizarre ways that she does. I mean, there's a very specific reason why she doesn't call the police. But I think there's also a much wider question of why she reacts in the way that she does, and I think she herself is not sure of that until quite late in the film, and I find that really interesting. And I find the fact that she has, that there are no easy answers with her character, just refreshing and brilliant, and all down to Hooper. I mean, she's talked about the fact that she and Verhoeven basically didn't speak about the character at all, really. He made the film, she did the character, and they genuinely did not apparently talk about it on set at all. So, you know, it's an incredible, incredible performance. And yeah, she was 100% robbed. This is one of the most fascinating, layered, weird performances that I have ever seen, even from Hooper. And I think for that alone, it would be worth seeing. But I think there's a lot of different questions in this film about what it means to be independent, what it means to be strong, what it means to be, I don't know, what it means to be violent, what it means to be a victim. I think it made me think a lot about all of those issues, and it didn't give me answers to any of them, and I thought that was quite good. But I agree, it is extremely upsetting. Certainly it is triggering for anyone who might be triggered by it. Please, you know, bear your own health in mind that way. But it is, I thought, a stunning, stunning performance.
Yeah, and I do. I think that conflict in her character is amazing, and the fact that she is, I mean, one of the more complex female characters I can remember seeing on screen.
Yeah.
And I loved that. And I love the fact that she doesn't, as you say, kind of conform to this traditional, what we see as a victim role. And that she, you know, she is at times absolutely infuriating. She can be arrogant. All these things play along at the same time. And I really, that's one of the things that I really liked about the film. I think it's a very specific issue of a conflation between consensual violent sex and rape, which I think is a really dangerous ground to go into. And that for me is, and I didn't want her to suddenly kind of have an epiphany and become a nicer character and a better, do you know what I mean? That wasn't what I was looking for from her. But that intersection and that conflation, I think, can be a really dangerous. And I think creating art doesn't take you out of the responsibility of being very careful when you kind of venture into that,
yeah,
that those areas. But yeah, she's amazing. I mean, there's the levity also she brings, that there's real humour in this film, oh, yeah, as well. And you know, there's some, she just has the best withering look I've ever seen on screen.
She's unbelievable, like that,
just,
way, yeah.
I mean, she is on, I mean, it's an incredible, incredible performance. But yeah, I think that's that central issue is something really challenging. But yeah, ultimately she completely, completely holds this film, 100%. Yeah,
she does. I mean, not to say that the supporting cast isn't good. I think they are. She's kind of surrounded by, there are hints of male violence all around her. There's a sort of, you know, the, even the games company and the games that they're making are super violent, all this kind of stuff. There are all of these hints all around her, and yet she's the one kind of taking responsibility for an entire extended family and basically carrying them all along with her. So, I don't know. I still don't feel like I've entirely unpacked it and entirely understand it, but I just find it absolutely riveting.
As indeed I found that.
Yeah, thank you.
That was great. I'll just leave. This is awesome. 4 stars then for Elle. Do go and see it. And then, last but not least this week, we have The Love Witch from director Anna Biller. Terry.
So this is, I have to say, unlike pretty much anything I've ever seen at the pictures ever. And I absolutely loved it.
As an advocate of The Greasy Strangler, that is saying something.
Do you know what I mean? There is no grease in this film.
Any stranglings?
No stranglings, no, okay, penis. I'm sorry, Chris. I'm just taking out all of the key ingredients.
That's it. I'm not going.
So this is a... okay, I'll start with the plot, because this is a difficult film to describe, but essentially it follows a young sorceress, as in a sorceress who enjoys witchcraft, who moves to a coastal California town. She's newly widowed and she's basically desperately in search of a replacement for her husband, who you eventually learn was murdered. And basically she does this through potions and witchcraft, and basically she... how do I say it? She woos in these men and then kind of disposes, yeah, of them.
When they're found wanting.
When they are found wanting, which they always are. Just let that sink in.
Men.
Men.
Whoa.
Can't live with them, can't kill them.
So it's visually, it's absolutely remarkable. So it's very much pays homage to kind of the old pulpy paperbacks, melodramas of the 60s. Samantha Robinson, who plays the lead role, is she's actually in the current issue of Empire magazine. She's in our intro slot in the front section, because we saw this film and we were like, wow, she's absolutely captivating. But it is genuinely quite a bonkers film. It goes on far too long. There's a good 20 minutes where there's a scene with somebody riding around on a horse, and there's knights, and they're in a forest, and you have no idea what's going on. And there was one bit where I was like, I'm really tired, but I think I might be hallucinating a little bit. But it's beautiful, and it's really surprising. She is incredible. And I pretty much loved it. But I think this is definitely one that you either totally give yourself over to and go with, or you go, what is happening? This is this is so stupid.
Everything
is mental.
I haven't seen this film yet. I really want to see it, because the notices for this movie have been fantastic from the off. Well, one thing that's really struck me about this movie, every still I've seen from it, the colours and the art direction, and feels like something that's been ripped from, I'd say probably the 40s or 50s in terms of its look,
yeah.
But obviously it has very, very modern sensibilities.
Yeah, it's quite shocking when somebody pulls out a cell phone and you're like, wait, what? This isn't... Oh, okay, sure, I guess.
Yeah, it's... yeah. It is, but it is, and that kind of commitment to the visual execution of this film is remarkable. The detail in it is absolutely incredible. And when we photographed her for the magazine, I was really shocked that she didn't look like she looks in the film, because like in my head, that's who she now is. But you know, again, it's a very kind of female fronted. It's very much a feminist film, I'd say. Chris, you're looking at me.
I'm feminist.
Appalled.
What is that?
I know there's the word men in feminist.
Oh, men.
Yes.
A men.
Yes.
Oh, I like that. I'm on board. Does she play a man then?
Yes.
Okay, I'm on board.
But it's the female gaze, which I think is interesting because, you know, so many of the films, especially the big Hollywood films, are very much about the male gaze. This is very much about the female gaze. Go watch it, Chris.
I am. It's on my list.
You'll
of
love
things
it.
To watch. If only I wasn't been waylaid by a house move, I would have watched it by now. But there you go.
Oh.
Yeah. Moving house.
It's all good, neighbour.
It's all good. And shout out to Dave, who took my inventory check of my old flat yesterday. He's a big fan of the podcast, apparently. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Dave.
He's probably lying. He probably doesn't listen at all. But what did we give it? 4 stars?
4 stars.
4 stars in for The Love Witch. I'm excited about this film. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast in association with 3. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Bill Condon, director of Beauty and the Beast.
Who lies all this time?
Empire Spirit Animal Dan Stevens. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Terry.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to read more about this Meninism? Meninists? This sounds exciting to me.
No, Chris, no.
You know, when is International Men's Day?
November 19th.
Oh, okay.
And every other day, Chris.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair. Yeah. I'm off to check my privilege. See you guys next week. Thanks
for listening.
You're so woke. I'm a woke bae. We've established this. Thanks for listening.